This is Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, it's Ben. Thanks for listening to A Small Voice podcast. Welcome along. I've tried to do this intro about 85 times so far. I don't know what's going on with me today. So let's try and get through it without having to start from scratch. It's not that complicated. I've got Mike Brody on this week, American photographer. Many of you will be fans of Mike's work and perhaps will have a copy of A Period of Juvenile Prosperity on your shelves. His first one, a much lauded photo book, and has been, I think, reprinted, he said, six times so far. You may even have one or two of the ones that came out subsequent to that. The most recent one's called Failing, which came out only last year. Also published by Twin Palms, who published the first one. Anyway, I will introduce Mike in a minute. Well, there's no ads this week, actually, so that's nice for all of us. Well, not so nice for me, because obviously I need the ads. It's incredibly important to me to have sponsors in order for me to continue to do the podcast, because it wouldn't be possible otherwise. On that note, actually, it wouldn't be possible if I didn't have my wonderful cohort of members. So don't forget, you can sign up. If you've been sort of toying with the idea of signing up as a member, it's £5 a month, or whatever that is in your currency, and you can sign up at pod.fan, and there's links in the show notes and on your player app there. So yeah, go ahead and become a member if you want to support the show, but also, more importantly, if you want to gain access to exclusive member-only content, because you're not just giving me a donation, you're paying for something special and extra, which is like a whole other episode that goes out on the week that this one doesn't. So for instance, Mike, after we had our main chat, which you're about to hear, we did what we call the bonus questions, which is another 25, 30 minutes of additional material. And everyone gets those questions now. So that's what you get as a member. You get to listen to those answers, which actually were really interesting as far as Mike goes, and nearly always are interesting. And also we do a check-in with a previous guest. So I've got 200 odd guests, 50 or so have done it already, I don't know how many, but 200 odd guests, let's say, ballpark figure, who I still have to catch up with and find out what they've been up to since I spoke to them first time, which in some cases, as I've said before, it could be almost 10 years ago now. So yeah, that's what you get. Also, there will be other additional member-only content when we figure out what that should be. And, you know, everyone gets a say in what that might be. So if you're a member, you know, you can make suggestions as to what else might be useful or interesting or helpful to you as either a photographer or a fan of photography or, you know, whatever it is. Something we can all sort of perhaps decide, well, not between us, because that's decision by committee and that's always a nightmare. Basically, I will decide, but always receptive to any suggestions or ideas. Anyway, enough about that. Go to pod.fan if you want to sign up as a member. Also, my newsletter is now on Substack, and you can find that under A Small Voice at Best, is basically what it's called. And that should be weekly, and has not been consistently weekly, because I've been a bit rubbish with that. And I'm sort of trying to figure out what form it should take, in a sense. At the moment, it's a kind of a roundup, really, of what's going on in Photoland. And I think it's important to sort of pass on information about exhibitions and festivals and Kickstarter campaigns and all that kind of stuff. So that's sort of what I'm using it for. But maybe I'm missing a trick there, and I could say more, and we could talk more about some of the issues that are going on in the world of image making. And also I could say more about, I guess, the podcast and the experience of having spoken to whoever my guest was that week, and indeed what's going on for the members. So hopefully that would encourage some of you to join up if you feel like you're missing out. If you've got FOMO, I don't know if that would actually work in practice. Yeah, probably would. I think, yeah, there'd be good things going on for members only. So let me just introduce Mike. This is the bio from the Twin Palms website. I did ask Mike if he had a bio that I could use, because otherwise I have to write my own, which I have very often done. And it's amazing how few people have got a decent bio just sort of ready to go. Even if they have a bio, it's quite often, frankly, pretty bad. But anyway, Mike didn't have one either, but he did say he kind of likes this one on the Twin Palms website, and I like it too. It's actually really nice and well-written and kind of a bit more interesting than your average bio. So I will take the lazy route and just read this, because to be honest, I'm not really going to improve on this. Mike Brodie's first monograph, A Period of Juvenile Prosperity, was published by Twin Palms more than a decade ago in 2013. Depicting his fellow rail riders and drifters in a rebellious and wildfire pursuit of adventure and freedom, Brodie leapt into the life of picture making as if he was first to do it, Danny Lyon wrote about the book in Aperture. Next came Tones of Dirt and Bone, a collection of earlier SX-70 pictures Brodie made when photography first led him to hopping freights when he was known as the Polaroid Kid. An SX-70 is a Polaroid camera, just in case you don't know. And then Brodie seemed to disappear from the art world as suddenly and mysteriously as he'd first appeared. Maybe his vanishing was another myth. Maybe it was just a necessary retreat. I was divorcing myself from all that, he says. I was growing up. I was pursuing this other life. In Nashville, he became a diesel mechanic, fell in love, moved across the country again, got married, bought land on the long, dusty Winnemucca Road Johnny Cash sang about, started his own business, built a house, put down roots, and when that life exploded, the open road called again. Throughout almost all of it, his cameras were with him, and at last those pictures are coming to light. If Michael Brodie's first monograph was a cinematic dream, his latest failing, again published by Twin Palms in 2024, is The Awakening and the Reckoning, a raw, wounded and searingly honest photographic diary of a decade marked by love and heartbreak, loss and grief, biblical in its scope and in its search for truth and meaning. Here is the flip side of the American dream, seen from within. Here is bearing close witness to the brutal chaos of addiction and death. Here are front seat encounters with hitchhikers and kindred wanderers on society's edges, sustained by the ragtag community of the road. Failing often exists in darkness, but is tuned to grace. Brodie's eyes stays forever open to the strange and fleeting beauty that exists in forgotten places, the open country and the lost horizons that sweep past dust-spattered windows in a spectral blur. So there you go. Quite lyrical, isn't it? Which I think is appropriate to the work and to this conversation that you're about to listen to. So, yeah, Mike was on a little European tour to promote a film which he has sort of collaborated on and is also the subject of, and it's called Slack. It was directed by Mike's collaborator and friend Cyril Lachar, and it's named after Mike's one-time girlfriend Mia Justice Smith, who sadly died of a drug overdose at a very young age, and I think to whom the film is basically dedicated. So Mike was over here in London and dashing about to a couple of other places in Europe. And it was great to do it face-to-face in the world's tiniest hotel room in Soho. We sort of sat on the bed while his lovely partner and young baby very kindly accommodated us by staying out of there for long enough for us to get the chat done, which was super sweet of her. So anyway, I hope you enjoy this, I think, very interesting and enlightening chat I had with Mike Brodie. I'm so glad we're doing this. I love doing them face to face like this, because now it tends to be, you know, on the screen more.
Yeah.
Which is great, because then I can talk to someone halfway across the world and all that. But the fact that you're here in Europe, because you don't get over here all that often, do you?
No, I've never been here.
Have you not?
Yeah.
Is your first time to Europe?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel at home, but also like a foreigner.
Yeah.
At the same time.
That's quite exciting. Let's just establish where you've been. You went to Germany first.
Yeah, I went to Berlin. The whole trip kind of revolves around premiering a film that I made with my friend in Berlin, Germany. So we premiered the film there, then went to Rome, and then Bristol, and now I'm here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In London. Okay. And so, yeah, like you say, the film is called Slack, and it was directed by your friend Cyril Lachauer.
Yeah, Cyril Lachauer, something like that. We both kind of mutually, creatively directed it. and he did all the filming. I did a couple shots, but he handled all the film and loading the film and using the camera. All the cinematography is him. Mm. And but we both kind of creatively made it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the timeline? Like, when did you and Cyril meet? Was this during your rail riding years, or was it after that?
It was after. I was pretty much settled down and more or less happily married. I was living in the town of Winnemucca, Nevada with my ex-wife. We had 20 acres. And I built a house and we were living there. And I met Cyril online. Kind of, we were both members on this online chat group, or it was like an online forum. We were both on there where people discuss train hopping information and traveling. And we met on there. And he realized who I was, that I was a photographer in the United States, and he had hopped trains, and he wanted to just basically meet me and collaborate on something. So he had lived in LA previously, because that's where his son was born. His son was born there. And so he was either already in LA or he flew there and drove up all the way to Northern Nevada to meet me. And we just casually drank some beers and talked about the future and possibly collaborating on an art project together, revolving around a film. We didn't know what it would be about. We just wanted to do something together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So once you started working on it, how long did it take?
The core of this film took... Really, the core of it was all... It was all shot in a year.
Oh,
so
okay.
The tail end of 2022 and then into 2023.
Yeah.
So it was multiple trips, but the core of it was all short. The core of it was all shot in a very short period of time.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So this involved kind of, he sort of dragged you back into that world, as it were, in order to do that.
Yeah.
Or your previous life.
He kind of did. And that's kind of been a struggle I've had my whole life, where I get dragged back into a world that I've been trying to grow out of, you know? So I was married. I didn't really have a desire to go train hopping. So when we first started talking about the project, obviously it related to going and hopping trains, because that's what I'm known for, because I've done it so much of my life. But I didn't necessarily want to go hop trains just for fun to shoot a film. There had to be more of a motivation. Why are we riding trains? Like, so I didn't know if it was going to happen. So yeah, the creative desire to collaborate pushed me kind of back on the rails, and just life circumstances. But it all happened naturally. It all happened naturally, organically. Mm. Mm. But yeah, he very much did. The film did drag me back onto the rails.
Yeah.
It's weird how life works like that.
Oh, of course. Because you had to really, it's a sort of portrayal of that stage in your life,
yeah,
in a sense, but
exactly.
Obviously shot, you know, after the fact.
Yeah.
And Slack, was the name of your girlfriend Mia.
Yes.
It was a kind of nickname for her. So
exactly.
It's named after Slack. So it's partly her story.
Yeah, we named it after her kind of posthumously. It just felt like the right thing to do. We could have initially we planned on making, I have some posters here, so I might as well take them out. I saved some.
Oh yeah, cool.
Well, whatever. They're rolled up. Yeah. It'd be cool to look at it. We named it the film Slack after Mia Justice Smith, who was my ex-girlfriend and also a photographer. And initially, the film me and Cyril planned on making in 2019 didn't involve her, because I didn't even know her. We hadn't even met.
Right.
You know? So what we were going to make was just... the way I saw it was train hopping, traveling as two men in their own respective lives and documenting those experiences. But after I went through a divorce, and then after my relationship with Mia and all that went down in my personal life and everything else, and after she died, it only felt like the right thing to do to somehow figure out how to honor her life in a way, you know. So we added that into the film. Well, we didn't even add it, because the whole film, all our travels ended up being inspired by her life, because she died, and then I kind of got pretty down and depressed and started drinking, you know.
Hmm.
Just I was a little lost. So it was a perfect time for Cyril to come to the States and travel with me, because I was just roaming and just kind of figure out what to do next.
Yeah, you were Well, you were grieving, presumably.
Yeah, grieving. Yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah.
She died of a... She was an addict. She died of an overdose.
Yeah, slack. She was a drug addict since the age of 16 or 17, maybe. Until 23.
I mean, we need to go back in a way, sort of, to the beginning, because you discovered train hopping, I think, as a sort of teenager.
Yeah, when I was 17.
But it's felt like you said, I think you said at one point that, you know, the trains kind of represented a way to escape in a sense.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
But what were you escaping from? I think you had quite a difficult, like your dad was in and out of prison. And
yeah,
stuff.
My dad's out of prison now, but I didn't grow up with a father, so he's been in and out of my life, mostly out of my life, you know, and so I guess I wasn't even escaping anything as much as I was searching for something.
Right.
And naturally in life, we do that, especially, I mean, if you're a young man, you grow up without a father to kind of set you up with the right tools to navigate the world as you come of age and figure shit out, you're just kind of lost, you know? So
you don't have that foundation.
I didn't have a foundation of like work ethic or just anything. I had no foundation. You know, my mom would help a little bit, and she of course gave me great motherly advice throughout time, but it's not the same as a father to really, you know, grab you by the arm and be like, look, here's the next step. You know, and so
you have to figure that stuff out for yourself.
Yeah, so I had to figure that stuff out for myself. So when I was 17, 18, 19, you know, all into my 20s, I was just traveling and searching. My mom would always say, what are you running away from, Mike? So I just enjoyed traveling. It was fun. But naturally, I mean, honestly, I was running away from things. I think it got to the point where I was running away from responsibility and this idea of growing up and all those normal things that you have to do at some point, or you never really find peace, I don't think, you know.
Did the photography, but like you discovered photography at what point? Were you already hopping trains?
I've discovered photography, it kind of was just a transition. When I was a teenager, 13, 14, 15, I watched a lot of BMXing and like skateboard videos. So it wasn't necessarily photography, but I saw an artistic medium, you know, filming and photographs in the magazines I'd look at. But I didn't tell myself I wanted to be a photographer. I eventually started playing around with video cameras and stuff. But it wasn't until I started hopping trains and meeting those people, the people in that community, you know, just punks in America, crust punks, hopping trains, traveling through town, and the beauty that was just in their life, some of their lives, just, I was so attracted to it and wanted to photograph it. So that's when I really took it seriously in my heart and started really trying to get good traditional portraits of people. So it went hand in hand, train hopping, photography, pretty much the same time.
Exactly. The
pretty
two
much
things,
the same time.
It was almost like a perfect kind of symbiosis in a way, because I imagine, you know, if you're in that life, it just lends itself to photography. I mean,
exactly.
Maybe you would have done it anyway, but I guess having the camera gave you another reason to do it.
Yeah, I did. The camera was so there was never any wrong train. You never caught a wrong train. There was never a bad experience. I mean, a lot of risky stuff, but it didn't matter what happened because the camera was there. And at the end of it, if I got a couple photos of something, it was worth it.
Mm.
So yeah, the camera was something I could lean on when other aspects were a little shitty. At least I had my camera, and everything was more or less interesting, you know. Mm. So it wasn't that difficult to find things to photograph. Obviously, it took work, and I had to have a certain eye for it. But that stuff was always around me.
Yeah, because you're not trained, or you didn't have any kind of knowledge of photographic history or anything like that. It was very an instinctive kind of approach. You just, you know, did your own thing.
Yeah, it's
without any references.
Yeah, most of my life photography has been instinctual. I feel like it's changing now that I've become so self-aware of a career kind of that I've made for myself with my work now. So now it's a different perspective. Now when I look through my camera, obviously a good photo is going to come instinctually, but now I know there's the background of what I've done already informing my photography. So I don't know if it's a good or bad thing, but
yeah, I was thinking about that. Yeah. Like, do you think how maybe I'm jumping ahead too much. I was thinking about your new book Failing, mm-hmm. which I guess nearly all of that was shot after a period of juvenile prosperity.
Yeah, almost all of it. We snuck in two pictures from that time. No one would ever know. Actually, people might know. There's the guy, he's picking at I think it's a really nasty staph infection on his shin. And he's picking at it with a safety pin.
Yeah.
And he was like this crust punk kid in Pensacola, and I took that photo in 2006. It should have been published in a period of juvenile prosperity, but we had that, and I was like, oh, you know, this seems appropriate towards the end of Failing with kind of the darker aspects of life, and he's picking at this nasty, like, wound. Mm. But anyways, 99% of it is taken in the past 10 years, past 5 to 10 years of my life.
Yeah. And because I was going to ask about whether you feel like there's a noticeable or kind of tangible difference in the way that you shoot or the kind of pictures that you've taken. Obviously, there's no trains, but forget about that. Just in terms of everything else, from the first book to Failing.
Yeah, I think there's a noticeable difference. I don't think the book is as exciting. Mm. You know, it doesn't have that exciting movement of youth. There's still movement. Like in some of the photos, I'm train hopping. A lot of those photos were taken while I'm on a freight train. But there's something, the way I've started to observe the world, I wouldn't say it was different, but I was living more of my adult life with responsibilities and work and marriage and always having my camera with me kind of as a tool in my toolbox or an accessory, like in my truck always. So I wasn't, it was a little different because I wasn't trying to document a people, like a group of people that I was just obsessed with. It was just me consistently having a camera and photographing moments in my personal life and otherwise. Right. So naturally it became a different thing. Mm. And the way we processed the photos created a different feeling. It's a very different book. Naturally, I think I wanted to make the book the same as a period of juvenile prosperity. Like I wanted it to be the same size and just like a continuation, but it didn't make sense because there was a different feeling there.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot more pictures in there. I think I'll come back to it because it's very recent. Only just came out really.
Yeah.
You know, the end of last year. So we can kind of stick a pin in it and come back to it because I want to go back to period of juvenile prosperity. So you talked about the beauty in these people's lives, and a lot of people talk about that book as being romantic. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Like to me, there's, you know, it's still that those lives are not necessarily romantic. And I think actually Cyril's film is interesting because watching Cyril's film kind of really does sort of, it leaves you in no doubt actually that there was a kind of darkness to that kind of life and a kind of lostness as you know, you've
very
already
much, sort of very
said.
Much so. Yeah. Yeah. There's romance to be had, but for the most part, it's not a romantic way of life. It's quite miserable. But what it becomes is an addictive lifestyle. You know, it just becomes addictive. Going from town to town, getting your beer or getting your high or meeting an old friend, going to a show. You know, it becomes this it becomes like this almost migratory pattern where you can't settle down. You're just kind of following odd jobs or good weather and catching the next train. And there is romance to be had. Like I've had amazing times with friends and ex-girlfriends and seen the most beautiful, you know, scenery and rainstorms. But usually it revolves around being intoxicated. So, you know what I'm saying? Because it's so rough. Like, you just get so dirty and so exhausted, and you kind of have to cut off. You have to take the edge off by always being a little drinking, right. Which is normal. People drink. It's part of life. Yeah. You get off work and you drink because it's a hard day.
Yeah.
You so there's romance there, but eventually it becomes an addiction, the lifestyle.
Yeah. And I guess, when we're speaking of addiction, I mean, obviously, there is a lot of that. People who, you know, for whatever reason, are using drugs, again, maybe to escape, you know, whatever. Like someone like Slack, I mean, of course, I don't know her backstory, but I've got to imagine that, you know, to get into intravenous drug use at a young age, just something bad has happened in order to do that. I mean, for the most part, anyway, I would think. But it's almost like the flip side of the American dream in a way? No, it partly is the American dream in the sense of freedom and stuff, but there's a weird kind of combination of things.
Yeah. What's the word? Like the flip side. There's a paradox in the lifestyles. Like, a lot of people spend their whole life like maybe admiring that lifestyle, train hopping. Oh, I want to do that one day. And one day they want to quit their job or like quit living the normal life and go do that. But then once you start doing that, traveling and train riding, you eventually kind of want to settle down. Like, so many of my friends are on the road and they just keep moving and moving and moving and they can't settle down. They can't stay in one place. Like, why is that? You know, there's like this strange discontentness with their life. It's like the American dream has offered too many opportunities. You know, the American dream, there's almost too many options. Mm. You can kind of do anything. So when you have that much freedom and that many options, maybe it's almost like it's detrimental.
Yeah.
Because you can do anything or be anyone. And then you're like, oh, well, shit, I don't know who to be or where to live or what I should do. So I'm just going to keep on going to the next town. And maybe, you know, there's an opportunity there, or maybe the love of my life is there. Maybe that town will give me what I want. But some people just keep going and never finding it.
Yeah.
Never find it.
That's funny, actually. Yeah. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the experience I had of driving across the US. And I had that sense of, you know, this kind of constant need to keep, like, let's go to the next place. And, you know, you sort of, you're always looking for America in a way.
Yeah, you're always looking for the country that you live in.
I mean, obviously, I was coming at it from an outsider's perspective, but yeah, it's something that Slack says in the film, which is interesting, which is she's talking about, you know, the other people in that life, and she's saying that for most of them, it's a performance, I think, is the way that she describes it. This is a kind of performance. It's a thing that they'll do and then they'll stop doing. But then it's very sad. She talks about herself and she's saying something like, it's not for me. It's not that for me. Is that kind of it, really?
Yeah, well, it's tragic, really, because what she says, I 100% agree with. And I've said it for a long time. You know, many young people, they take to the lifestyle in many ways because it's hip. It's cool. It's like a fashion statement. So you're young and carefree and you're just following the herd in a way, doing what your friends are doing. And then before you know it, you got a lot of face tattoos. You dress a certain way. You have you've developed some bad habits. And then you keep doing it. It kind of just becomes a performance. You're just kind of, like she said, you're performing. It's not oftentimes it's not the real person. Do you know what I'm saying?
You're sort of adopting
adopting a persona almost that you're kind of pressured into, whether it's social media or just your peer group or just trying to find yourself, that finding yourself, you know? And then there's the point where she says, this will never end for me. I think she's just trying to be tough, like, I'm the real deal. I'm gonna do this forever, mm-hmm. you know? But then tragically, she dies shortly after. But that speaks on what she said also, like, this will never end for me. It was almost like it sounded suicidal almost. I don't know. It's very creepy in a way, you know?
Yeah, because these things take on a sort of added meaning after the fact.
Yeah, because she went into the lifestyle really hard. Like, I only knew her for 9 months, honestly. And now I'm going to know her for the rest of my life because of what she left behind and the story, you know, I'm creating with her art and then this film. But what I'm glad you picked up on that, because that's a really important part of what I'm talking about, even part of my own upbringing, is the performative nature of maybe many subcultures. Like, you have to act a certain way to get into the club, and then you finally get into the club and you realize everyone's kind of a fucking asshole and doesn't care about you. Then you want to get out of the club and you're like, oh, it's kind of too late. I got the pass.
I got
the badges. It's signed in blood. I can't get out of this. And then you kind of get stuck. And so then that's kind of what happens too. Then you kind of get stuck in it, in that particular lifestyle, and it becomes this very, it becomes dark and a lot of nihilism and just self-destruction. And so everyone starts to resign to the fact, everyone being a lot of like the crust punks, like that ethos of punk is kind of this idea where I'm not going to live past 30. So you might as well just fucking do whatever.
Yeah.
Who cares? Yeah. One more face tattoo, one more beer.
Right.
And so, man, it's not, it's sad looking back, because I'm 40 now, so I've known a lot of people to come in and out of the life, including myself coming in and out of the life. So that's kind of how we tried to show Slack in this film. What she left behind with a lot of her footage and stuff was, she's kind of a symbol of that life.
Mm.
And she lived it, and she lived it real and really hard, and
we should make clear that you were gonna have a baby together. She was pregnant when she died.
Yeah, she did. She was.
So, you know, you must. Yeah, that's gonna like rip your life apart.
Yeah, it sucked, because I've been wanting to be a father for a long time. I was married for 8 years, but just didn't work out. So me and my wife got a divorce, and then I met Mia, and I guess I'm crazy, but yeah, I fell in love with her, and naturally I wanted to be a father, and I did want to have a child with her. I thought she was very beautiful. I knew it was kind of a bad idea because of the circumstances of her life. It's like, okay, I'm going to have a child with a drug addict. You know, that's not smart. But it was worth the risk. I don't have any regrets. I think everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything happens for a reason. And I have a son. Like, you know, this is a... I have a son now.
Yep.
With a woman I met shortly after, you know, Mia passed away. And now I have a son, you know.
Right, right.
Maybe he existed all along, you know. Yeah. It just...
Yeah.
Here he is now. It just, everything happens for a reason. So it's important not to dwell on the what if.
Absolutely.
You know.
So you, like you say, you've got a 5-month-old son and a new partner who, so you've been together for
It's been 2.5 years.
2.5 years, okay.
Yeah.
But then, okay, so let's just, just to kind of fill in the gap. So when you finished, when you threw in the towel on the rail riding and you tried to, you know, have a normal life, and you got married, as you say.
Yeah.
So you were fully going down the road of just a normal
guy. My whole life, I've just been trying to be a normal guy. Well, actually, no, at first, I wanted to be a not normal guy.
Yeah.
And then I was successful at that. And then I was like, oh, you know, well, the normal life actually seems kind of appealing, you know?
Right.
And so in 2014, I got married, and I bought a house, and went to work for the railroad. So yeah, I tried to be just a married man, a working class guy, and it did work. I think I was good at it. But it just doesn't, there's something off. I'm an artist. As much as I try to bury that down, sometimes I try to deny that part of me. I'm an artist, and it's there, and I have to express that part of me, otherwise my soul kind of dies inside. So,
what's interesting is, like, do you need some sort of grit to be inspired to take pictures? I mean, like, are there any photographs from that time, as it were, or did you basically put your camera away?
Not that many photographs. So there are some. Yeah. There are some. But, like, 2010, 11, 12... 12, there's a few. 13, 14, 15, just not that many photos.
Yeah.
16. I think when I lived in Nevada, Nevada was a very beautiful place. And so every day looked beautiful. Everything I was seeing and the people I'd work with. So I'd say 2017, 18, 19, 20. And I met Mia in 2021. So that it started to pick up the creative energy. But there was definitely a time period where it was kind of dead. And I would just randomly snap photos because, like I said, my camera was always around. I always made sure that I always had a camera with film, usually.
Right.
So I would snap some, and some of it made it in the book. But
it's no coincidence that that period of kind of not, you know, being creative was coincided with the attempt at a normal, you know, like regular guy kind of life.
So I guess to your question, my life does need to be a little chaotic and crazy. I got to lean on that for the creativity, you know. If I'm sitting in comfort, maybe my creative spirit dies.
Goes into hibernation.
It doesn't die. It goes into hibernation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's been this push and pull for years, you know. So
yeah, you say that, you know, you're constantly... There is that constant push and pull, you know, the allure of a real nice, stable life with a home and a wife and all
which is so easy, and I could have it just like that. I know how to do it, but why am I not doing, why do I need to, like you just heard me talking to Mouse Green about going to Iraq and photographing mechanics. Why do I want to do that?
Well, I can I'll ask you later, but
it's like, why don't I just stay home?
And because it's part of your creative personality, I suppose, that you know, the creativity isn't just in the photography, it's in the life that you're trying to lead.
I guess you're right. It's the whole, it's not just taking the pictures, it's the whole life.
Because, like, now, A Period of Juvenile Prosperity, it was a very successful book, right? I mean, I don't know whether it did it take you by surprise. That it was so well received.
It didn't take me by surprise, but I was happy about the notoriety and the success from it. But it didn't take me by surprise because I really worked hard on those photos, you know. So I put in a lot. I put a lot into the world, and some positivity came back out of it. It does surprise me recently how there's renewed interest in it. Like, it's gonna get, that book's will be getting reprinted for the sixth time.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's cool. So there's new generations of people who respect it as art. Yeah.
It's a seminal photo book. You know, it's in the Martin Parr, Jerry Badger, significant photo books. They have three volume set. It's in there, which is always a kind of almost a tick of approval in terms of it being a significant piece of work. But and also you talked about the fact that you earned some money which you'd never really had before. I think not so much from the book but from selling prints. Is that more?
I had two exhibits in 2014 in LA and New York where I was able to audition some of the images from that book and sell them. So I made a good amount of money in a very short period of time, which helped and hurt my life. Because, I grew up in poverty, so it's like I didn't really learn how to, I wasn't taught how to manage your money when you get it. So I'm still the type of guy, if I get money, I already try to, if I get 10 grand, I'm already figuring out what I can buy that costs $9,500.
Yeah, right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, you said it. I was going to ask the question. You know, was there a way? Was there a sense in which it was a negative? You know, that the success of the book, and you've already now alluded to it, that the money, in some ways, in what respect did it, you know, cause you problems or be,
just you know the old phrase, more money, more problems.
Yeah.
You know, when you get more money, well, not you, not everyone, but it. More money, you end up becoming motivated to do things for different reasons. You can easily get a big head about what you're capable of. Like all of a sudden, you have X amount of dollars in your bank account and you think you know how to run a business. Or you think you know how to manage. You know, you just think you know how to do things just because right. You have that money backing your,
yeah,
your
it's kind
ego.
Of validation.
But it's like, but then the money goes away. You're like, oh, I guess I wasn't very good at that because I don't have any money left. So it's just more money so you can buy stuff. But, you know, maybe it's a lifelong skill and maybe I'll get better at it as time goes by. But I don't know. I think my art brain really fucks it up because I'll justify why I should under the idea of art, I can justify any expense. If I have some money, I can justify why I need to buy this thing for $3,000 because it's part of the art, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's an investment.
I need it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, some photographers and artists, you know, spend their whole career trying to, you know, make any money at all. So in a sense, you've kind of done a lot more than a lot of people managed to do.
No, I am very grateful. I am grateful when I'm able to sell some photographs because it gives me opportunities to do things like travel a little bit to foreign places. And most all my photographs I've taken when I was kind of had nothing, you know, because that's that creative kind of filament. You know, like a filament is fragile and it's about to blow out if it has too much amperage. So that's where I operate with photography. I kind of need to be struggling and not really have much. And then that's where I thrive because then I have to get creative and you have to use your imagination to make ends meet or get the photos or like, oh, I only have 3 rolls of film left. You know, like there's a book in Failing, actually. I wish I could show you now. It was at the tail end of this long trip I did alone. And I was coming back home on a Greyhound bus. I just left, I was coming out of Amarillo, went through Salt Lake City, Utah. I had one picture left on the last roll of film. It was 32 rolls of film. I had one picture. And I took a picture of the back of the bus driver's head in the Greyhound bus. And it came out, I've never taken a photo like this. It just has, the sun is setting, perfect glow, perfect kind of elements in the bus. It's just perfect. And how? And I think it has to do with I had this one picture left. I was at the end of this trip and there was something about that was magic, you know, and luck. But so there's something about the struggle and living with less that I think is better for your soul. It's good for you, I think, to when you can basically it's not all about the money is what I'm saying.
Well, also, that is the romance of shooting on film, that you have a last frame. Because with digital, you never have a last frame because you've got a card full of, thousands of...
Or maybe the battery dies. That's your last frame.
Right, yeah, yeah. The pictures in Failing, it's a very dark book to me. I had a look at it and, in a sense, it feels like it's a darker period than the Period of Juvenile Prosperity. By the way, it's such a great title, Period of Juvenile Prosperity.
Oh,
I meant
cool.
I presume you kind of, it's meant ironically to some extent, or is
there
it?
Is some irony there. I didn't title it. It was titled by the guy you see on the cover, sleeping. His name's Soup. He titled it. That was the last, he accidentally titled it. That was, he wrote, there was an initial introduction that he wrote for the book and we didn't use it because it was a collective effort kind of editing the book. And so we didn't use the introduction. It just didn't work. But the very last sentence in the introduction said he was summing up his life experiences while photographing or being on the road. and he was describing that time, and he said, for me, it was a period of juvenile prosperity. And so that was perfect for the title.
Yeah,
that's perfect. What we used.
Yeah, that just landed right there in your lap.
So, yeah.
But failing, I guess, well, you were coming out of the end of your marriage at that point. The darkness of the pictures in some respects perhaps, you know, reflected your inner kind of feelings.
Yeah, they reflected my emotion at the time. And I had help with my friend Paul Sheik. He's always helped me edit my photos. We edited the photos together. Started at about 600 images and then worked it down to about 200 or so. But yeah, it reflected. Obviously, your emotional feeling at the time in your life goes into how you edit the photos. But also, some of the photos literally are just dark by nature.
There's a lot of kind of death and...
Literally.
And some really kind of gnarly, to use a technical phrase, some really gnarly shit.
Yeah, and some literal shit.
And some literal shit, yeah, exactly, which is
A lot of it is morbid curiosity. I mean, if I'm walking by somewhere and I see a dead homeless man, I had to take a photo, you know, or the payphone covered in shit. Like, when do you see a payphone with shit smeared all over the keys? Well, when do you see a payphone?
Period.
But this payphone had shit smeared into the keys. You know, there's certain things like... There's a lot of things I took photos of in the book that I never thought would be published. It's just things that I had to take a photo of at that time because I was seeing it just in my travels.
So you work in that way that, you know, basically if you see anything weird or off or in any way unusual, that you want to photograph.
Not necessarily because it's not like I've been around a lot of death. But the first time I ever saw a dead man, it was in San Francisco. I was walking down the street. And there was just a dead guy laying on the road between two cars. He fell over, cleanly dressed, didn't look like anything suspicious went on, and I didn't take a photo. Mm. We called 911, and I didn't take any photos.
How do you know when not to?
I don't know. Just something tells me. I mean, obviously, there's an aesthetic composition that has to exist, but it's a feeling, and that's all it is. It's just a feeling.
There's an
impulse.
Yeah. There's a bit in the film which is interesting where you're sort of, it feels like you're tussling in a way. You're talking about you're saying that good photography involves exploitation, or you're trying to kind of figure that out almost there and then, as it were, in your head. It feels like, anyway.
Yeah, I was.
And you're almost tussling with it. So it's kind of quite a funny moment in a way, because you're not sure. You can tell that you're not sure, you know, and you're quite open about it. You're like, is that right? You know, like, because it's an interesting, the whole, you know, we're all very much aware of our kind of ethical responsibility in this day and age, especially, I think, as photographers, and I think that's quite right. But perhaps it's something a lot of us tussle with. Are you a bit more clear now on where the line is there, as it were, or not?
No, because I'm still kind of, when it comes to, I'm still not clear on where the line, I think the word has been ruined, exploitation, I don't even know what it means anymore, but the ethical responsibility makes sense. Mm. So obviously, by nature, one would have an ethical feeling towards someone or about someone. So even making this film about Mia's life, it's about my life too, but incorporating parts of her life, we involved her mother. We wanted to get a blessing from her mother to make sure she was okay with what we were doing, and, you know, portraying this slice of her daughter's life. So, you know, ethically, me and Cyril, we had to talk with her and get her involved. Otherwise, we're just kind of being scummy guys making a film about someone who's dead, even though it was my girlfriend. It doesn't matter, she's gone. And so there's always an ethical responsibility, but the lines blur, and sometimes you just have to fuck up your reputation for sake of the art, or, you know, because it's worth the do it first, ask for forgiveness later.
I think
is, you got to do it sometimes. But for the most part, every time I photograph people, it's a mutual enjoyable thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where a lot of them, especially if I photograph older people that I was hitchhiking with or working with, they're flattered. They, you know, they someone was interested in them. being photo, like, oh, this guy is photographing me.
Yeah.
I must be special. Even when people photograph me today, I'm like, oh, cool. Thanks.
Yeah, you know? Kind of being recognized.
Yeah, thanks. It's human nature to like it. So usually it's a mutual okay thing.
Of course. Yeah, and it's not that difficult to, we all get to make judgments, you know, reading body language and reading the room and all those things that they're just instinctive things. I mean, not everyone is good at that stuff, but I think if you're going to go around photographing people, you better figure out how to do that somehow.
Yeah. The initial exploitation idea was lingering around a lot when I was first making a period of juvenile prosperity photos, because I was technically documenting a subculture that has never been documented in that way. You know, I mean, punks have been documented. Like, you can go back to into the not late 60s, but 70s, the 80s and 90s. There's been documentation of punks in Europe and United States, but not necessarily like these train riding, the hobos, that kind of lifestyle. So that's when the exploitation thing was, everyone wanted to talk about that, but that's just because people were in fear of losing their subculture. Like, it wasn't going to be a thing if you put a bunch of pictures of train hopping on the internet, but nobody cares.
Right.
There's YouTube channels. You can go hop trains. It's just this American tradition. You know, you just go get on the train and ride it. Mm. You know, there's no, is there really any rules? You know, it's like.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, has this, the process of doing this film with Cyril, has that, you know, kind of sparked an interest in the moving image for you as a kind of thing that you might explore more of?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think about it all the time. I don't know how much I'll physically use, like, a video camera. I didn't enjoy it. I shot with Cyril's camera. A few shots in the movie were mine. Really didn't enjoy it. I couldn't see through the viewfinder. It was hard. I didn't enjoy it. But I spent a lot of time every day visualizing a feature film I want to make, or scenes in a feature film, or ideas I have that I would like to put into a film one day.
Mm.
So I don't know what that'll look like, what my job will be, will it be writing, or how I'll do that. But I would hope that what me and Cyril did together inspires us.
Yeah.
To continue on with the art form, even if just some more experimental, photography related travel, that'd be fine too. But I would love to take the next step and do like a feature film inspired by real life events.
Yeah,
you know,
I can see it. I can see the feature film of a period of juvenile prosperity.
Yeah, yeah.
The feature.
World, it seems like the world wants it, because I get lots of people asking me. People contact me all the time wanting to make a film inspired by these photos, and it's just, if only it was that easy. Mm. You know, I guess I can't just say yes, let's do it, because it's like
it's notoriously the hardest thing in the entire universe to get a film on the screen.
Yeah, like, what do you do, just go rent a train for your movie? You know.
Yeah.
So I think the need to do it is there. But
do you think that world has changed since you were involved in it, or in as much as you would know, I suppose?
Train hopping?
Yeah.
Since I was involved, since I started?
Yeah, has the world moved on a little, or have there been some ways in which it's not the same?
It's all still there in the same ways, except there's more phones.
Yeah.
So I think the rugged kind of, there was an archetype of a hobo that's pretty much gone. I mean, you meet a lot of, there's homeless, transient bum types you meet in America, but as far as the train riders, it's still a lot of young punks, but they all have phones, so there's such a reliance on technology. So it's like, people, rather than really learning where you're going or learning to navigate a certain train yard or understanding old railroad maps, people will share, well, this is what I noticed and that I've done, people will share pin drops,
right?
You know, like a Google pin drop. Here's the pin drop of where I caught that train out of Chicago. So we're just like, it's kind of strange. So it's like, people do it, but they're missing this deeper element that existed in generations past.
Yeah, because I've got to imagine that there's a certain amount of knowledge that kind of gets passed down, right?
Yeah,
as to so that, how you actually do it.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And now it's all like, yeah, just right there on the phone kind of
thing. Yeah. Yeah, but it's all still there. It's, you know, well, you got people doing YouTube channels. So you got a there's several notorious train hoppers that do YouTube channels. And they're real hobo. I mean, they're real hobos. They're living it. It's like a real hobo life. But I can't, it bores me because I can't just sit there and watch the YouTube.
Well, people watch all kinds of things.
Yeah, people
on
like
YouTube.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. They're probably, well, they won't be hobos for long. They'll end up, you know, multimillionaires with a massively successful YouTube channel. Then they'll kind of, defeat the whole object because they'll have to get a normal life or whatever.
Yeah.
Where are you? So, like, yeah, we said earlier, you've got a very young baby and a partner. So, in that push pull that we talked about, where are you right now? Like, what's going on with you? Are you making pictures of normal life or?
Well, yeah, naturally what's going on with me is, naturally, again, I'm trying to live a normal life, but it's not really working. But I've just been learning to use this Leica camera. So I just take pictures of my baby and all that. But it's still a struggle. Like, I have a house. We rent a home in Pensacola, Florida. We're not there right now. I have a lot of opportunities in the world, like we were just talking about, to get into feature filmmaking or doing photography projects. But really, what's more important, doing that or having a healthy relationship, getting married and having a nice home life? I think for my future, that's the best route. Mm-hmm. So how can I do my art and have a nice home life at the same time, you know? So I really am trying to figure that out.
Difficult one, because your art is the way that you could also finance your life.
Yeah,
but
if I played my cards right, I could do art and then, you know, make a whole year's salary doing a project maybe for that takes a few months. You know, I don't have to work 9 to 5 because it doesn't work. I've tried over and over and over, and I just get depressed. And
oh, you do? Because I thought at one point, obviously you did that at one point, you became a mechanic.
I've probably worked at 10 different companies.
So you got a, you know, you're trained in that. You always, that's a sort of fallback, right?
Yeah, I'm a journeyman. Like, I'm a diesel mechanic by trade, so I know how to do that. I have the tools, but if I do that work regularly, on the daily, I get just depressed.
It's not as cool. It's not as cool as being an artist.
No,
that's for sure.
No. I mean, you
know, even if the being an artist is not all it's cracked up to be, as we know. I mean, sometimes it is. And so, so I guess you've got to find a new way of producing work that's based on something else.
Yes.
I think you said something about you wanted to, I don't know, photograph pretty things or, you know, something of
that. Yeah, I mean,
nature.
That was just a generic way to
you're sick of that.
Yeah, I don't want to
life, maybe?
Yeah, just, it was a generic way of saying, all my photography in the past came from a lifestyle that was very much like could kill me if I'm not careful, you know, and you know, killed a lot of my friends, you know. You know, it didn't kill them. They made choices in their life that brought them to their death, obviously. There's other outside worldly forces, but I don't want my art to come from that place anymore. Mm. You know what I'm saying? I want it to come maybe a little more intentional and mindful of the whole picture now that I have a son. And what he expects of me as a father, you know, I can't just leave and be like, okay, I'll come back and I'm going to go do this thing and I'll come back in 5 months. No, that's not how I want to be. But
I mean, you had the experience of not having a father. So I guess once we become fathers, the first thing we want to do is like not make the same mistakes.
Yeah, I would like to break
make.
That cycle. That
break
cycle.
The cycle.
That'd be nice.
But going away, you know, I've spoken to so many photographers, obviously, and that tussle of having to, you know, the so-called work-life balance, which is kind of a myth, but a lot of people have tussled with that, especially, you know, photojournalists and documentary photographers who, you know, have spent vast amounts of time on the road or abroad, you know, just working, because that's what the job entails, obviously.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe... then regretting that they didn't spend as much time with the family. It's a very difficult thing to balance.
Yeah, and then on not even just in the arts, in just all aspects of work, you know, like you can be in the trades and jobs will expect you to fly to go do this job for 3 weeks on a whim, you know, to give your life to a company, to go work away from your family, to make that money, to support your family, but then you're not there. So what effects is it having on your family when you're not there? So yeah, the work-life balance thing is a real thing we have to grapple with in modern life, because for me, I'm like an all or nothing person. Mm. So it's hard to find a balance when I'm doing anything. But you got to figure it out somehow.
With failing, the book is kind of broken into beginning, middle, and end. What was the thinking there?
That was Paul Sheik's idea. Mm. I think I wouldn't say it was lazy. It just seemed like a natural course. I don't know why he did that, but I think there were so many photos. And I think quickly looking through the photos, he felt three different, when he helped me edit it, I think he just felt three obvious different things. Mm. And so he just did beginning, middle, and end. And at first I didn't like it. I was like, oh, that's just too generic. Mm. But then it made a lot of sense. So we tried our best for the beginning to feel more bright and hopeful. And then the middle was still some movement and travel, and there was some beauty there, but it got darker. And then the third chapter became even more there. We took away titles, or the titles of photos became sparser and the photos got darker, literally the colors and the content. And it just broke up naturally. It broke it up for viewing better, because it's hard to look at 193 photos in a row. So breaking it up is a good natural, just to have a break, you know. It could have just been a black page and it would have been helpful.
It kind of makes sense, because all good stories have a beginning, middle, and end, right?
Yeah.
And narratives, you know, like three act structure and all that is as old as time.
Yeah. So we did our best to create a narrative without forcing it too much, you know, because we're working with photographs and not a real. There was no real narrative. It's photographs, and then you look at them and you use your imagination to fill in the blanks.
You have to create your own narrative.
Yeah. And a lot of it was intentional, obviously, but you can only say so much with a still image.
Paul's been quite important. Paul, of course, runs TBW Books, so he's a book publisher by trade. But he didn't. He could have published the first book himself, I guess, and he sort of pointed you in the direction of Twin Palms, which was the publisher.
Yeah.
Which was a very selfless thing for him to do, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think at that time also he didn't. I don't think he had the means.
Right.
I think he saw that the work, my photos, were a little bit beyond him. Does that sound bad? Beyond what he should be doing. He just seemed, he says it deserved to go to the best, to be published by the, you know, someone who's been making books in a time-honored traditional way, like Jack Woody was with his book publishing company. And Paul was just starting out. So it just, he naturally knew it was a better fit.
Right.
And I think he likes since then he's just liked helping me, supporting my work in the background as a friend. And like even with failing, he just helped me edit it. I asked him to publish it and I think he kind of was interested, but I think logistically or the money was too expensive to make that many books. You know, like they're heavy. So just too much of a headache. I think he liked a more casual. He likes to casually work with me and just help with the photos. Everything else gets a little too heavy.
Yeah. You know, fair enough. I think
that's what the deal.
Yeah. Do you enjoy the editing process, or is that more of a kind of chore to you?
I enjoy it. I didn't really enjoy it with failing because we were just work. I was using an iPad and we were doing it on Zoom because he lives in Mexico now.
Okay.
So I thought that was pretty fucking annoying. But that's just modern life now.
Everything's like, on screen.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to meet you in person. Well, it just worked out.
Me too.
Coincidentally.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, the fact that you were coming to London at the time that we were talking about trying to do this is just a fantastic coincidence.
Yeah. So I'm trying to get away from all the technology that's just kind of killing our creativity and like alienating people from one another. It's just not good.
We're just living in this weird fucking isolated universe. I mean, I don't get out of my house most of the time. Yeah. I don't know. And I'm worried about my kid. And my kid is 15. So anyone who's got a teenage boy in particular will totally relate, I would imagine, that, you know, they're in that kind of world as well, you know. And yeah, he does sport and stuff, so it's not entirely a lost cause, but yeah, those are the things you worry about for sure.
Yeah, you never know. That's like a critical time, coming of age.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you want him to learn social skills. You know, you want him to sooner or later he's got to figure out how to talk to girls, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
I don't think he'd have a clue how to talk to a girl because he doesn't go out into the world. Anyway, I don't know how we've gone down that track. This is something you don't have to worry about for another 15 years.
I'm already worrying about it.
Right.
And my son's only 5 months old.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's already trying to crawl into the phone screen. Ooh.
Oh, yeah. No, you've got to keep him away from those devices.
I know.
Now, look, I sort of overheard part of a conversation earlier. What plans do you have for future projects or life in general? You were talking about, we don't even have to keep this in, but you were talking about the possibility of going to Iraq to work.
Yeah, that'd be interesting in my lifetime. I've never been, and I never thought I'd want to go. But my friend Mouse Green, he lived there for a while with a friend. Actually, he still lives. He goes back and forth, but they have a lot of, there's different areas. I don't know exactly where, but I've seen photos. There's different neighborhoods that work on a lot of American-made diesel-powered machinery, you know? And I love that. I love machinery. I love the working man and just like all that stuff. And a lot of the old obsolete stuff that's been kicked out of America because of emissions goes to places like Iraq or Africa or Mexico, where they can run it because the laws are different in regards to air quality.
Right.
And so, but those were all some of the best, most reliable machines, because a lot of fully mechanical, not a lot of electronic systems. And so I just think a lot of that stuff's beautiful. Like and so I want to photograph it.
Right.
So, I could find that stuff in America as well, but it's a little harder to find. You got to go into the nooks and crannies and back roads.
Mm.
But I like the idea of photographing men working on machinery in Iraq, and then whatever else happens.
Yeah.
Like whatever. You can't really plan things.
Mm.
You kind of have an idea, and then you'll see where the idea takes you. But yeah, I don't know if that'll happen. That's just a random...
Okay, yeah.
Well, we were talking about it last week when I saw him in Berlin, and then we just started talking about it again.
Right. Yeah, we won't hold you to it. Is it. Like you say, it's just one of many ideas that you might kind of come up with.
Yeah, it's all just a continuation of photography. Like in Failing, you'll see there's some machinery or work-related photos. So
does that come of like being around the train locomotives, that kind of interest?
It's always been around ever since I was since I rode BMX bikes, taking apart my BMX bike and greasing the bearings and fixing the rims and, you know, with a couple basic tools and keeping it all under my bed out of the way. Like I'm always been mechanical, you know. It's naturally I want to take things apart, put them back together. Sometimes I put them back together.
Yeah.
So it's a perfect union, kind of the beauty of machinery and mechanics and things and the way men work with their hands and then the aesthetics of it and photographing it. So, but it's hard to get it in the right way.
Mm.
It's hard to join those two forces of art and then the working life and actually make it a real visual, nice language that says something greater than just like a man standing there, you know, with a wrench. There's more to it.
You have to think about whether that would, how that could be resonant with people, or how that could be, you know, of interest, or do you not even worry about the audience, as it were?
No, I don't worry about the audience, because naturally I don't worry about the audience. I'm the audience and my desire to do it. But obviously, if I didn't worry about the audience, no one would share you wouldn't share your work with the world. That's a normal desire, I think. But there still is very much always this urgency, just like with my early work, to photograph things. I was talking about it earlier, like this desire to photograph things that are passing away. Like there's very much a world that's passing away, you know. Eventually, certain things will just never exist.
Mm.
Eventually, generation after generation, you know, unless there's just means of preservation. But so I'm just attracted to these ways of life or ways of working that are very much passing away right now, you know, with each generation. And so
what will be the next phase as far as making work in the US goes?
That's a good question. Speaking of Paul Sheik, I think he mentioned, I guess sometimes artists apply for Guggenheim, like it's like a grant or a fellowship or whatever, which is nothing I've ever been too eager to do because I've never needed help with my art. I just buy some film and take some photos of life. But I, for the first time in my life, I'm thinking about a photo project I want to do. Whereas in the past, it's always been me just taking photos
of your life,
of my life, and seeing what'll happen. Well, of course, I still will photograph my life, but it's in a new context of a project that maybe if I had the opportunity, like getting some funding from Guggenheim or getting some exterior funding to support it, what would that look like, and how would that affect my work? Would it be positive or negative, or you know? So now I'm. There is a lot that I want to photograph, but I don't quite know what it's going to look like. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Or I might go into the filmmaking thing. I'm not sure what the future holds, you know? But I definitely, I'm not going to quit photography. I'm enjoying taking photographs. Even if I never have a book that's as seminal, like you say, it's a period of juvenile prosperity, it'll still will be something I have to do.
Yeah, you sort of peaked early, as it were, you know. Yeah, maybe that's going to be the kind of cross you have to bear, that sometimes you kind of hit it hard the first time, and then for the rest of the rest of your career, you're trying to kind of in some way reproduce the success of the first thing
naturally. Yeah. And it just doesn't really happen. And even Martin Parr, I was at his place yesterday and he was showing me his first book, and he said, yeah, it's still the most successful book. It was his first book, and it was from like 19. It was from the 80s.
Yeah, and he's done like 100 or 150.
That's what he said. Yeah, but he has my first book. It's still the best one.
Yeah, that's good to know. All right, Mike. Well, look, thank you so much. It's been great to do this, and especially to do it face to face here in London. And thank you for taking the time to chat with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, Ben. Thanks for the opportunity.